Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to episode of Living Loud Outdoors. On the mic with you. It's story time. It's Saturday. Let's see if we can get into chapter 3 of This Present Darkness. Man, I hope you're enjoying this as much as I am. I love this writing. I love how it depicts the spiritual warfare. We've been talking a lot about that. I hope you're seeing it. I hope you get to see more as we move through this book. It's a pretty lofty one, but chapter 3, This Present Darkness. Just a few miles east of town on Highway 27, a large black limousine raced through the countryside. In the plush back seat, a plump, middle-aged man talked business with his secretary, a tall and slender woman with long jet black hair and a pale complexion. He talked crisply and succinctly as she took fluid shorthand, laying out some big-scale business deal. Then something occurred to the man. "That reminds me," he said, and the secretary looked up from her memo pad. "The professor claims she sent me a package some time ago, but I don't recall ever receiving it." "What kind of package?" "A small book, a personal item. Why not make a note to yourself to check for it back at the ranch?" The secretary opened her portfolio and appeared to make a note of it. Actually, she wrote nothing. It was Marshall's second visit to Courthouse Square on the same day. The first time was to get Bernice bailed out, and now it was to pay a visit to the very man Bernice wanted to string up, Alf Brummel, the chief of police. After the Clarion finally got to press, Marshall was about to call Brummel, but Sarah, Brummel's secretary, called Marshall and made an appointment for 2 o'clock that afternoon. That was a good move, Marshall thought. Brummel was calling for a truce before the tanks began to roll. He pulled his Buick into his reserve parking space in front of the new courthouse complex and paused beside his car to look up and down the street, surveying the aftermath of the festival's final Sunday night, death throes. Main Street was trying to be the same old Main Street again, but to Marshall's discerning eye, the whole town seemed to be walking with a limp, sort of tired, sore, and sluggish. The usual little gaggles of half-hurried pedestrians were doing a lot of pausing, looking, head-shaking, regretting. For generations, Ashton had taken pride in its grassroots warmth and dignity and had striven to be a good place for its children to grow up. But now there were inner turmoils, anxieties, fears, as if some kind of cancer was eating away at the town and invisibly destroying it. On the exterior, there were the store windows, now replaced with unsightly plywood, the many parking meters broken off, the litter and broken glass up and down the street. But even as the store owners and businessmen swept up the debris, there seemed to be an unspoken sureness that the inner problems would remain. The troubles would continue. Crime was up, especially among the youth. Simple, common trust in one's neighbor was diminishing. Never had the town been so full of rumors, scandals, and malicious gossip. In the shadow of fear and suspicion, life here was gradually losing its joy and simplicity, and no one seemed to know why or how. Marshall headed into the courthouse square. The square consisted of two buildings tastefully garnished with willows and shrubs, facing a common parking lot. On one side was the classy two-story brick courthouse, which was also housed the town's police department, and that somewhat decadent basement cell block, one of the town's three squad cars, was parked outside. On the other side was the two-story glass-fronted town hall, housing the mayor's office, the town council, and other decision-makers. Marshall headed for the courthouse. He went through the unimposing plain doorway marked police, and he found the small reception area empty. He could hear voices from down the hall and behind some of the closed doors, but Sarah, the secretary, seemed temporarily out of the room. Behind the receptionist formica topped counter, a huge file was slowly rocking back and forth, and grunts and groans were coming up from below. Marshall leaned over the counter to see a comical sight. Sarah, on her knees, dress or no dress, was in the middle of a blue-streak struggle with a jammed file drawer that entangled itself with her desk. Apparently the score was file drawer 3, Sarah's shins 0, and Sarah was a poor loser. So were her pantyhose. She let out an ill-timed curse just as her eye caught him standing there, and by then it was too late to rebuild her usual poised image. "Oh, hi, Marshall. Wear your marine boots next time. They're better for kicking things in." at least they knew each other, and Sarah was glad for that. Marshall had been in this place often enough to become well acquainted with most of the staff. "These," she said, with the tone of an articulate tour guide, "are the infamous file cabinets of Mr. Al Brummel, chief of police. He just got some fancy new cabinets, so now I've inherited these. Why I have to have them in my office is beyond me, but upon his express orders, here they must stay. They're too ugly to go in this office, in his office. But khaki, that's for him, you know. Oh well, maybe a little decoupage would cheer them up. If they must move in here, the least they can do is smile." Just then, the intercom buzzed. She pressed the button and answered, "Yes, sir." Brummel's voice squawked out of the little box. "Hey, my security alarm is flashing." "Sorry, that was me. I was trying to get one of your file drawers shut." "Yeah, right. Well, try to rearrange things, will you? Marshall Hogan is here to see you." "Oh, right. Send him in." She looked up at Marshall and only shook her head pathetically. "Got an opening for a secretary," she muttered. Marshall smiled. She explained, "He's got these files right next to the silent alarm button. Every time I open a drawer, the building's surrounded." With a goodbye wave, Marshall went to the nearest office door and let himself into Brummel's office. Alf Brummel stood and extended his hand, his face exploding in a wide ivory smile. "Hey, there's the man. Hey, Alf." They shook hands as Brummel ushered Marshall in and closed the door. Brummel was a man somewhere in his 30s, single, a one-time hotshot city cop with a big bucks lifestyle that belied his policeman's salary. He always came on like a little likable guy, but Marshall never really trusted him. Come to think of it, he didn't like him that much either. Too much teeth showing for no reason. "Well," Brummel grinned, "have a seat. Have a seat." He was talking again before either man's cushion could compress. "Looks like we made a laughable mistake this weekend." Marshall recalled the sight of his reporter sharing a cell with prostitutes. "Bernice didn't laugh the whole night, and I'm out $25. "Well," said Brummel, reaching into his desktop drawer, "that's why we're having this meeting, to clear this whole thing up. Here." He produced a check and handed it to Marshall. "This is your refund on that bail money, and I want you to know that Bernice will be receiving an official signed apology from myself in this office. But Marshall, please tell me what happened. If it had just been there, I could have put a stop to this." "Bernie says you were there." "I was? Where? I know I was in and out of that station all night, but..." "No, she saw you there at the carnival." Brummel forced a wider grin. "Well, I don't know who it was she saw in actuality, but it wasn't at the carnival last night. I was busy here." Marshall had too much momentum by now to back off. She saw you right at the time she was being arrested." Brummel didn't seem to hear the statement. "But go on, tell me what happened. I need to get to the bottom of this." Marshall halted his attack abruptly. He didn't know why. Maybe it was out of courtesy. Maybe it was out of intimidation. Whatever the reason, he began to rattle the story off in neat, almost news copy form, much the way he heard it from Bernice. But he cautiously left out the implicating details she shared with him. As he talked, his eyes studied Brummel's office and any particular details in decor, layout, agenda. It was mostly reflex. Over the years, he had developed a knack for observing and gathering information without looking like he was doing it. Maybe it was because he didn't trust this man. But even if he did, once a reporter, always a reporter, he could see that Brummel's office belonged to a fastidious man, from the highly polished, orderly desk right down to the pencils in the desk caddy, every point honed to perfect sharpness. Along one wall, where the ugly filing cabinets used to stand, stood an attractive set of shelves and cabinets of oil-rubbed oak with glass door panels and brass hardware. "Say, moving up in the world, huh, Alf?" Marshall quipped, looking toward the cabinets. "Like them? Love them. What are they?" "A very attractive replacement for those old filing cabinets. It just goes to show you that you can do it if you save your pennies. I hated having those file cabinets in here. I think an office should have a little class, right?" Yeah, sure. Boy, you have your own copier?" "Yes, and bookshelves, extra storage, and another phone." "A phone? What's the wire coming out of the wall?" "Oh, that's for the coffee maker. But where were we anyway?" Yeah, that what happened to Bernice?" And Marshall continued his story. He was well practiced in reading upside down, and while he continued to talk, he scanned Brummel's desk calendar. Tuesday afternoon stuck out a little because they were consistently blank, even though they were not Brummel's day off. One Tuesday did have an appointment written down, Reverend Oliver Young at 2 p.m. Always said conversationally, going to pay my pastor a visit tomorrow. He could tell right away that he had overstepped his bounds. Brummel looked amazed and irritated at the same time. Brummel forced a toothy grin and said, "Oh, yes, Oliver Young is your pastor, isn't he? You two know each other? Well, not really. We've met on an occasional, professional basis, I suppose. But don't you go to that other church, the little one?" "Yes, Ashton Community. But go on, let's hear the rest of what happened." Marshall was impressed at how easy this guy was to fluster, but he tried not to press his challenge any further. Not yet, anyway. Instead, he picked up his tale where he left off and brought it to a neat finish, including Bernice's outrage. He noticed that Brummel had found some important paperwork to look over, papers that covered up the desk calendar. Marshall asked, "Say, just who is this turkey cop who wouldn't let Bernice identify herself? An outsider? Not even one of our force here. If Bernice can get us the name or badge number, I can see that she is confronted with this his behavior. You see, we had to bring some auxiliaries down from Windsor to beef things up for the festival. As for our own men, they all know full well who Bernice Kruger is," Brummel said at the last line with a slightly wolfish tone. "So why isn't she sitting here hearing all this apologizing instead of me?" Brummel leaned forward and looked rather serious. "I thought it best to talk to you, Marshall, rather than use or cause her to parade through this office. Already somewhat stigmatized, I suppose you know that girl's been through." "Okay," thought Marshall, "I'll ask. I'm new in town, Alf." "She hasn't told you? And you'd love to?" It slipped out, and it stung. Brummel sank back in his chair, just a little studied Marshall's face. Marshall was just now thinking he didn't regret what he said. "I'm upset, in case you hadn't noticed." Brummel started a new paragraph. "Marshall, I wanted to see you personally today because I wanted to heal this thing up. So let's hear what you have to say about Bernice, Brummel. You'd better choose your words carefully," Marshall thought. Well, Brummel stammered suddenly and put on the spot. "I thought you might want to know about it in case you might find the information helpful in dealing with her. You see, it was several months before you took over the paper that she herself came to Ashton. Just a few weeks before that, her sister, who had been attending the college, committed suicide. Bernice came to Ashton with a fierce vindictiveness, trying to solve the mystery surrounding her sister's death. But we all knew it was just one of those things for which there will never be an answer." Marshall was silent for a significant amount of time. "I didn't know that." Brummel's voice was quiet and mournful as he said, "She was positive it had to be some kind of foul play. It was quite an aggressive investigation she had going. Well, she does have a reporter's nose." "Oh, that she does. But you see, Marshall, her arrest, it was a mistake, a humiliating one, quite frankly. I really didn't think she would want to see the inside of this building for some time to come. Do you understand now?" But Marshall wasn't sure he did. He wasn't even sure he had heard all of it. He suddenly felt very weak, and he couldn't figure out where his anger had gone so quickly. And what about his suspicions? He knew he didn't buy everything this guy was saying, or did he? He knew Brummel had lied about not one being at the carnival, or had he? Or did I just hear him wrong? Or where were we anyway? Come on, Hogan. Didn't you get enough sleep last night? Marshall? Marshall looked into Brummel's gazing eyes and felt a little numb, like he was dreaming. "Marshall," Brummel said, "I hope you understand. You do understand now, don't you?" Marshall had to force himself to think, and he found it helped not to look at Brummel in the eye for a moment. It was a stupid beginning, but it was the best he could do. "Hey, yeah, Alf, I think I see your point. You did get the right thing, I suppose. You did the right thing, I suppose. But I don't want to heal this whole thing up, particularly between you and me." "Oh, don't you worry about it. It's no big deal." Even as Marshall said it, he was asking himself if he really had. Brummel's big teeth reappeared. "I'm really glad to hear that, Marshall. But say, listen, you might give her a call at least. She was hurt in a pretty personal way, you know." "I'll do that, Marshall." Then Brummel leaned forward and with a strange smile on his face, his hands folded tightly on the desk and his gray eyes giving Marshall that same numbing, penetrating, strangely pacifying gaze. "Marshall, let's talk about you and the rest of this town. You know, you're really glad to have you here to take over the Clarion. We knew your fresh approach to journalism would be good for the community. I can be straightforward in saying that the last editor was rather injurious to the mood of this town, especially toward the end. Marshall felt himself going right along with this pitch, but he could sense something coming. Brummel continued, "We need your kind of class, Marshall. You wield a great deal of power through the press, and we all know it. But it takes the right man to keep that power guided in the right direction, for the good and the common good. All of us in the offices of public service are here to serve the best interest of the community, of the human race, when you get right down to it. But so are you, Marshall. You're here for the sake of the people, just like the rest of us." Brummel combed his hair with his fingers a bit, a nervous gesture, then asked, "Well, do you get what I'm saying?" "No." "Well," Brummel groped for a new opener, I guess it's like you said, you're new in town. Why don't I simply try to direct the direct approach?" Marshall shrugged a "why not" and let Brummel continue. "It's a small town, first of all, and that means that one little problem, even between a handful of people, is going to be felt and worried about by almost everyone else. And you can't hide behind anonymity, because there simply is no such thing. Now, the last editor didn't realize that and really caused some problems that affected the whole population. He was pathological soapboxer. He destroyed the good faith of the people in their local government, their public servants, and each other, and ultimately himself. That hurt. It was a wound in our side, and it's taken time for all of us to heal up from that. I'll cap it off by telling you, for your own information, that the man finally had to leave this town in disgrace. He had molested a 12-year-old girl. I tried to get that case settled as quietly as I could, but in this town, it was really awkward, difficult. I did what I felt would cause the least amount of trouble and pain for the girl's family and people at large. I didn't press for any legal proceedings against this man, provided he leave Ashton and never show his face around here again. He was agreeable to that, but I'll never forget the impact it made, and I doubt the town has ever forgotten it. Which brings us to you, and we, the public servants, and also the citizens of this community. One of the greatest reasons I regret this mix-up with Bernice is that I really desired a good relationship between this office and the Clarion, between myself and you personally. I'd hate to see anything ruin that. We need unity around here, comradeship, a good community spirit. He paused for effect. Marshall would like to know that you'll be standing with us and working toward that goal. Then came the pause and the long, expectant gaze. Marshall was on. He shifted around a little in his chair, sorting his thoughts, probing his feelings, almost avoiding those gazing gray eyes. Maybe this guy was one up and was on the up and up, or maybe his whole little speech was some sly diplomatic ploy to shy him away from whatever Bernice may have stumbled upon. But Marshall couldn't think straight, or even feel straight. His reporter had been arrested falsely and thrown into a sleazy jail for the night, and he didn't seem to care anymore. This toothy smile police chief was making a liar out of her, and Marshall was buying it. "Come on, Hogan, remember why you came down here." But he just felt so tired. He kept recalling why he had moved to Ashton in the first place. It was supposed to be a change of lifestyle for him and his family, a time to quit fighting and scratching the big city intrigues and just get down to the simpler stories. Things like high school paper drives and cats up trees. Maybe it was just force of habit from all those years of the times that made him think he had to take on Brummel, like some kind of inquisitor. For what? More hassles? For crying out loud, how about a little peace and quiet for a change? Suddenly, and contrary to his better instincts, he knew there was nothing at all to worry about. Bernice's film would be just fine, and the pictures would prove that Brummel was right, and Bernice was wrong, and Marshall really wanted it to be that way. But Brummel was still waiting for an answer, still giving him that numbing gaze. Marshall began, and now he felt stupidly awkward in trying to get started. "Listen, I really am tired of fighting, Alf. Maybe I was raised that way, maybe that's what made me good at my job with the Times. But I did decide to move here, and that's got to stay something. I'm tired, Alf, and I'm not any younger. I need to heal up. I need to learn what being a human and living in a town with other humans is really like." "Yes," said Brummel, "that's it. That's it exactly. So, don't worry. I'm here after some peace and quiet just like everybody else. I don't want any fights. I don't want any trouble. You've got nothing to fear from me." Brummel was ecstatic and shot out his hand to shake it. As Marshall took the hand and they shook, he almost felt as if he had sold part of his soul. Did Marshall Hogan really say all that? I must be tired, he thought. Before he knew it, he was standing outside Brummel's door. Apparently, their meeting was over. After Marshall was gone and the door was safely closed, Alf Brummel sank into his chair with a relieved sigh, and he just sat there for a while, staring into space, recuperating, building up the nerve for his next difficult assignment. Marshall Hogan was just the warm-up as far as he was concerned. The real test was coming up. He reached for his telephone, pulled it a little closer, stared at it for a moment, and then he dialed the number. Hank was touching up his paint job in front of the house when the phone rang and Mary called, "Hank, it's Alf Brummel." Wow, Hank thought, and here I am with a loaded paintbrush in my hand. I wish he was standing here. He confessed his sin to the Lord on his way to answer the phone. "Hi there," he said. In his office, Brummel turned his back to the door to make it private conversation, even though he was alone, and spoke in a lowered voice. "Hi, Hank, this is Alf. I thought I should call you this morning and see how you are since last night." "Oh," said Hank, feeling like a mouse in a cat's mouth. "I'm okay, I guess. Better, maybe." "So you've given it some thought?" "Oh, sure. I've thought about it a lot. I've prayed about it. Rechecked the word regarding some questions." Sounds like you haven't changed your mind." "Well, if the word of God would change, then I'd change. But I guess the Lord won't back down from what he says. And you know where that leaves me." "Hank, you know the congregational meeting is this Friday." "I know that." "Hank, I'd really like to help you. I don't want to see you destroy yourself. You've been good for the church, I think. But what can I say? The division is bickering. It's all about to tear that church apart." "Who's bickering?" "Oh, come on. And for that matter, who called that congregational meeting in the first place? You? Sam Gordon? I have no doubt that Lou is still at work out there, as well as whoever it was that painted on the front of my house. We're just concerned, that's all. You're fighting against what's best for the church." "Well, that's funny. I thought I was fighting against you. But did you hear me? I said someone painted on the front of my house." "What? Painted what?" Hank let him have it all. Brummel let out a groan. "Aw, Hank, that's sick. And so is Mary, and so am I. Put yourself in our position." "Hank, if I were in your position, I'd reconsider. Can't you see what's happening? Word's getting around now, and you're getting the whole town against you. That also means the whole town's going to be set against the church before long, and we have to survive in this town." "Hank, we're here to help people, to reach out to them, not drive a wedge between ourselves and the community. I preach the gospel of Jesus Christ, and there are plenty who appreciate it. Just where is this wedge you're talking about?" Brummel was getting impatient. Hank learned from the last pastor. He made the same mistake. Look what happened to him. "I did learn from him. I learned that all I have to do is give up, bag it, bury the truth in a drawer somewhere so it won't offend anybody. Then I'll be fine. Everybody will like me, and we'll be all one happy family again. Apparently, Jesus was misguided. He could have kept a lot of friends by wilting and just playing politics." "But you don't want to be crucified." "I want to save souls. I want to convict sinners. I want to help newborn believers grow up in the truth. If I don't do that, I'll have a lot more to fear than you and the rest of the board. I don't call that love, Hank." "I love you, Alf. That's why I give you your medicine, and that goes especially for Lou." Brummel pulled a big gun. "Hank, have you considered that he could sue you?" There was a pause on the other end. Finally, Hank answered, "No." "He could sue you for damages, slander, defamation of character, mental anguish. Who knows what else?" Hank drew a deep breath and he called on the Lord for patience and wisdom. "You see, the problem," he said finally, "too many people don't know or don't want to know what the truth is anymore. We don't stand for something, so we all fall for anything. And now guys like Lou get themselves into a fog where they can't hurt their own families, start their own gossip, ruin their own reputations, and make themselves miserable in their sin, and then look for someone else to blame. Just who's doing what to whom?" Brummel only sighed. "We'll talk about it all Friday night. You will be there." "Yes, I will. I will be counseling somebody, and then I'll go in for the meetings." "Ever done any counseling?" "No." "It gives you a real aspect of the truth when you have to help clean up lives that have been based on a lie. Think about it." "Hank, I have other people's wishes to think about. Brummel hung up loudly and wiped the sweat from his palms. Wow, as we bring that chapter to a close, you can understand what's happening here. Again, we're talking about spiritual warfare. We're talking about things going on behind the scenes. There's obviously a lot of undertow. There's obviously a lot of current that's happening that's unseen, and it's obviously a spiritual battle that's happening in this little town, and this pastor has chose to stand against it, while there are some who are looking to undermine it. Man, I love this writing. I love how Frank Peretti puts this all together, this present darkness, and we're living in it ourselves right now. God bless you guys. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you for following along on our podcast. I pray that you consider all the things that are being spoken on our messages that come across this line. God's pouring out. We're in the last days. Much excitement around us. Much prophetic being fulfilled. Even as we speak, God's moving. God's Spirit is moving across this earth. He's calling us out for such a time as this. Join in the fight. Join in the purpose of seeking that which is lost so that they may be found. Amen. God bless you. Ron and I love you. We thank you for your support. Thank you for your prayers. God bless you. And we'll talk to you again real soon.